All right, we're ready to begin again. For those of you listening in, I wanted to remind both counsel and witness, especially for those folks at home, we need you to speak into the microphones as best you can so the folks listening in at home can hear as well as those here in the courtroom. So with that, we are back on the record, and Ms. Chin Kappen go on with the examination of Dr. Poshi.
Doctor, before we broke, I asked you, there are studies which have looked at the effects of mercury on health.
In this slide, we point out the methylmercury disasters and our epidemiology studies. And the next slide, please. In Minamata, Japan in the 1950s, what was first noticed was the cats would do a dance on the seashore. They chased their tails. And they traced this back to their eating fish. And then they began to find birds dead on the shore. Again, birds that had been eating fish on autopsy showed. And it was about 2 years later, it was found that there was a factory that was dumping mercury waste into Minamata River. That river would empty into the Minamata Bay. Because of the geology involved, the bay did not empty completely when the tides changed. So the mercury built up in the bay, settled into the sediment where it was converted to methylmercury. The people living around Minamata Bay were primarily fishermen. Fish were their primary source of protein, and it was soon found that the people eating the fish had certain neurological signs, including movement disorders, and that, more importantly, the children born of women who had eaten this contaminated fish, although the mothers did not appear to have any signs of mercury toxicity, the children had severe mercury toxicity, characterized by some as cerebral, what we call Minamata cerebral palsy. There are other central nervous system brain effects noted in these children. So this was the first methylmercury disaster, you might say. In Iraq in 1970, there was a famine. Because of our government looks after people all over the world, because there was a famine, our government donated to Iraq bags of grain seeds so that the farmers could take these seeds and plant them, get the grain, make flour, make bread, etc., etc. But the people were so hungry that they took the seed, which is always protected by a fungicide, a methylmercury fungicide, so the seeds are not, their biological activity is not inactivated by a fungus infection. On the bags, I think 110-pound bags of grain, that seed that was sent, it said, poison, do not eat, in either English or in some cases in Spanish. And our government did not realize was that most Iraqi farmers are illiterate in Arabic, as well as, of course, being illiterate in English. So they took this contaminated seed and ground it up, made a flour, made bread, and there are 6,000 cases in Iraq of methylmercury poisoning. And this is one of the two studies that our government depended on, Minamata and Iraq study, that made our health officials concerned about whether the low levels of methylmercury in fish that our children in this country are exposed to might be harmful to them. And therefore, next slide, please. Therefore, the Seychelles Island study and the Faroe Island study was set up, and I spoke to you about them already. And the enigma was, why are they so different? We now know there are a number of reasons, and I'll speak to in a few minutes as to why they're different. Originally, before the White House conference, the Seychelles Island study and the Faroe Island studies did not agree at all. However, a study done in New Zealand agreed with the Faroe Islands results. And this was very important for our EPA to switch from using the Iraqi data and the Minamata data to the Faroe Islands data as far as establishing an RFD.
Doctor, what is an RFD again?
RFD is the amount of mercury, in this case, the micrograms of mercury per kilogram of body weight per day that you can be exposed to the rest of your life, every day the rest of your life, with no harmful effects.
Is that a steady state of exposure?
The RFD would indicate what a steady state exposure would be. But none of us are exposed. None of us have a steady state exposure to methylmercury when we eat fish, for example.
And doctor, what is the reference dose?
The EPA reference dose is 0.1 micrograms of mercury per kilogram per day.
And doctor, did you compare that to the dosages of mercury that Michelle Cedillo received in her vaccines?
On her first vaccine dose, when she was, I believe, one day old, the Cedillo child received 12.5 micrograms of mercury. She had a body weight of approximately 3.6 kilograms, and that meant that her exposure was 3.5 micrograms of mercury per kilogram per day, which is 35 times the EPA RFD, or you might say the EPA safe dose. So this is quite high. And you'll see later on there are even higher doses that we'll point out. What was very interesting to all of us, I first heard about it on an airplane when I was going to a meeting with someone from Montreal. This young woman in Montreal is a professor of epidemiology studying people in the Amazon who were eating fish that were contaminated with methylmercury. And she had two groups. One group had no signs of methylmercury exposure. The other group had severe signs. And she traced the fact that the group with no signs had eaten a lot of oranges and citrus. And we think this, again, may be one of the reasons why the Seychelles Island study could not come up with these effects that the Faroe Islands did. I think the map, the world map, may be shown in the next slide. The Faroe Islands are roughly, I think, right there. The Seychelles Islands are roughly around here. So this is a tropical, subtropical area where there's a lot of citrus, a lot of grapes, a lot of oranges.
Those
of us who have been to the Faroe Islands, there are hardly any trees, never mind citrus trees. The people had to cut the trees down it's so cold up there for a few years ago. And to buy an orange, I wanted an orange one day when I was there for a week. I couldn't even find an orange for sale. So one reason for the Seychelles Island study not showing the effects that the Faroe Island study did was the Faroe Island subjects did not have protection of citrus.
Doctor, are children more susceptible than adults to the effect of mercury toxicity?
Would you say that again?
Are children more susceptible
yes,
to the effects?
I have the next slide. I think it's on the next slide. But first of all, let me just point out. Sorry, it's okay. Let me first point out that everyone is exposed to mercury, and this is from the National Health Council monograph that I was involved in writing of. Shows the estimated daily intake and retention of micrograms per day of mercury in the general population not occupationally exposed to mercury. But the numbers in parentheses is what is retained in the body. The numbers outside the parentheses that are not parentheses is the exposure. And you can see that the greatest exposure to the American population to mercury is via dental amalgam. Inorganic mercury is inconsequential, especially if very little is retained, 0.3. But in methyl mercury, almost all of the exposure to methyl mercury is retained. Methyl mercury stays in the body. And the next slide, I think, will say something. Children are not small adults. Very often, people just think they're smaller. We know their metabolism is different. We know that they absorb metals from their guts at a faster rate than an adult. And the central nervous system, the brain of embryos and children, are the most sensitive to methyl mercury. That's been clearly shown in animal studies and in human studies. Methyl mercury crosses the placenta. The placenta does not protect the baby again, or the embryo against methyl mercury. And methyl mercury and ethyl mercury have some similar properties, but their toxicokinetics are different. They're what happens. The rate of change in the body, the so-called toxicokinetics, are different from the kids.
So, Doctor, moving from methyl mercury to ethyl mercury,
can I have the next slide, please? Okay. The enigma for many years has been, why is thimerosal in vaccines? And this was brought up in a congressional hearing that was held a number of years ago, and it was, must be 4 or 5 years ago. The next slide, please. Since that time, the FDA has pointed out in the Federal Register of 1982, it states, the panel concludes that thimerosal is not safe for over-the-counter topical use, for drugs sold over-the-counter. For topical use because of its potential for cell damage if applied to broken skin and its allergy potential. It is not effective as a topical antimicrobial because its bacteriostatic action can be reversed. Bacteriostatic action can be reversed wherever it is. That's 82. So effective, or in the October 11th, 2005, these are not my words, this direct quotes from the Federal Register. The October 11th, 2005 Federal Register note stated, effective April 1st, 2007, a few months ago, a number of active ingredients have been present in over-the-counter drugs, drug products, for various uses as described below. However, based on evidence currently available, there are inadequate data to establish general recognition of the safety and effectiveness of these ingredients for the specified use. Thimerosal is quoted as one of these ingredients.
Doctor, what was the effect of this ruling in the Code of Federal Regulations?
The net effect has been it has prevented and stopped the addition of thimerosal to a tremendous number of health products, including vaccines. And about the only vaccine that still has, or the only vaccine that children are exposed to that still have thimerosal in it is probably influenza, although one can obtain now influenza vaccine-free thimerosal.
And that's to your knowledge currently? That's to your knowledge?
Yes.
Doctor, you had mentioned earlier about Pink's disease.
Yes.
What is Pink's disease?
Okay. Between approximately 1890 and 1950, a disease called acridemia, as other names that are here also, next slide please, was found in young children, very young children. I put this first because I want you to remember this, please. The medical establishment did not accept Mercurius mercury as the cause. And we'll say this again. The next slide, please. Children with Pink disease were miserable babies and toddlers. They had bright pink or red. They were bright pink or red in color. They were photophobic, with raw beef hands and feet. They had anorexia, peeling skin, and gangrene. In other words, the blood could not get to the extremities. Next slide, please. The mortality of children who got pink disease was 5.5 to 33%, very high mortality. Now, at the time, viruses were beginning to become known. Research was showing that some diseases were caused by viruses. And also at the same time, vitamins were the scientific rage. We were discovering new trace elements and vitamins that were required for good nutrition. So it was fashionable, and those are the words that the medical literature historians use. It was fashionable at the time to call it a viral disease or a nutritional deficiency. The next slide, please. And it was found that Mercurius mercury in teething powder was the cause. And what you want to remember also is that of 500 children exposed only to this teething powder that contained Mercurius mercury, only one would develop acrididia. Only one would get Paich's disease. One out of 500. So one must ask, were these children hypersusceptible to the effects of mercury? The next slide, please.
Doctor, when you say hypersusceptible, are you referring to the fact that the individual may be more susceptible to developing the disorder because of the genetic background?
Yes, and I'll later point out that we now have evidence that a specific gene has now been found that is affected by mercury.
Thank you.
The cause of pink disease was believed to be a hypersusceptibility to mercury, in particular Mercurius mercury. The medical establishment would not accept Mercurius mercury in the teething powders as the cause. Now let me say, the American medical establishment has always practiced excellent medicine. We're healthy for this very good reason. But it has also been extremely conservative to new ideas. The cause of pink disease has never been proven by the scientific method to be Mercurius mercury. But when the government prohibited the use of Mercurius mercury in teething powders, pink disease disappeared. Again, we must ask, were the 5.5 to 33% fatalities due to hypersusceptibility to Mercurius mercury toxicity?
Doctor, you indicate that there might be a potential genetic susceptibility to developing mercury toxicity. Are there any studies that support what you're saying?
May I? Yeah. So the question really is there evidence for genetic differences or hypersusceptibility in response to mercury exposure? Professor Woods at the University of Washington has worked with mercury for many, many years and worked with dentists. Showed that for dentists with low-level occupational exposure to mercury, 85% had the expected urinary porphyrin profile. Now, porphyrins are chemicals in our body that are on the way to making the heme of hemoglobin. So this is a very important pathway. And what happens in this pathway, as far as a change in the pathway, can be detected by examining the urine for porphyrins. So this is porphyrinuria, or porphyrinuria state. Now, what Woods has found and is now published in one of our primary first-class international peer-reviewed toxicology journals, found that 85% of the dentists with a low-level occupational exposure had the expected urinary profile. The expected urinary profile is different from people not exposed at all. There are certain porphyrins that appear in the urine. But 15% of these dentists with the same general exposure had atypical porphyrin urine. They had a new compound, a new porphyrin that was found in the urine. And this new compound was due to what we call polymorphism, or changes in the letters of the genetic code in a gene. The latter was due to polymorphism in the human gene that modifies the effect of mercury on a biological process. This human gene is the co-pro porphyrinogen oxidase gene. And this has been published. It was published in 2005, and there have been subsequent papers. Now, Mercury Review articles do not mention this. The articles that some of my dearest friends that I have greatest respect for just don't mention this article, because they obviously are ignorant of this article. Or, as we get older, we get more narrow in our vision, and perhaps the people who write some of these articles just don't realize that genetics has become more and more important in toxicology. So the Mercury Review articles do not mention this fact because the authors are not cognizant of genetics and genetic toxicology as an important area of human toxicology. The genetics of human mercury toxicity is just beginning, and this paper of Jim Woods is going to be classic as the first one. This is potentially a biomarker that we can test people in the future as to whether they are going to be susceptible to mercury toxicity. Next slide.
Doctor, how does this relate to autism?
Okay. I'm going to offer you evidence to try to answer the question, is autism a mercury efflux disorder? Now, let's say, define what a metal or mercury efflux disorder is, because there is good medical evidence that we have such disorders. Metals get into our body from our food, from the air that we breathe, get into the blood, transported to the tissues. And normally, because of the homeostatic mechanisms, and a large accumulation of toxic levels of those metals are prevented by a mercury efflux, a transport system that takes the mercury out of the cell or the metal out of the cell. Could you go back, please? I'm not ready for that. So an efflux disorder is a problem with getting a metal, in this case mercury, out of the cell. So what's the evidence for this? Let's skip the next slide. We'll come back to that much later. Wilson's disease. Wilson's disease has been known since the late 1800s. It's a genetic disorder characterized by a large amount of copper in the tissues. People with Wilson's disease, or another name for it is cataplexy tissue degeneration, people with this disease cannot get rid of copper. The copper accumulates in the brain, in the particular, and in the liver. My first academic appointment was at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine, and a neurologist called me one day and said, "Hey, Bath, I hear you're making penicillamine in the lab as a possible cancer chemotherapeutic agent." And I said, "Yes, Bert, we have plenty. Why?" And he said, "Well, did you see that paper by John Wall from Cambridge?" I said, "Yes. Why? Do you have a Wilson's disease patient?" And he said, "Come to my lab tomorrow. Come to my office tomorrow morning." I went there, and in a few minutes, a woman staggered in, hardly able to walk, hardly able to talk, about 24, 25 years of age. And in those days, the FDA regulation practically did not exist. So we took some penicillamine, and we very carefully prepared it, gave it to the pharmacist in our hospital, and the neurologist gave the penicillamine to this woman. And a month later, Bert Sprofkin called me into the office and said, "Come and see." And I walked into the office, the young woman stood up, came over and kissed me on each cheek, and that was a very young man, but that's it. And she was normal, right? And the Wilson's efflux disease is now treatable. It's one of the few genetic diseases that you give a chelating agent to, and signs and symptoms disappear. Now, we now know, this happened maybe 5 or 10 years ago, that Wilson's disease is due to a mutation in a gene called the ATP7B gene. Next slide, please. This gene codes for the ATP7B protein, which is a copper transport protein, the protein that allows copper efflux. And this is expressed primarily in the liver, where it's deficient back in Wilson's disease. The next slide, please. And there's hepatic and central nervous system copper accumulation and toxicity. Can everyone hear me all right?
Okay. Yeah.
And there are signs of hepatic and central nervous system or brain signs and symptoms. And what is unusual about Wilson's disease is it's a treatable genetic disorder. So we think other efflux diseases, maybe even autism, are treatable. Next slide, please.
Doctor, before we move on, copper, is that considered to be a heavy metal?
Yes, copper is a heavy metal.
And as is mercury?
As is mercury.
And doctor, have there been other studies that support what you're thinking is that autism could potentially be a efflux disorder?
Let me review some papers, if I may. The first paper is entitled Reduced Level of Mercury in First Baby Haircuts of Autistic Children. Amy Holmes was a practitioner, a private practitioner, not connected with the university, not connected with a research group, treating autistic children in Baton Rouge. She thought that she knew about the speculation about mercury and thimerosal being involved in autism. And she decided that one way that we may be able to show whether this is so or not is to get baby hair. The first haircut. Most of us who have children still have first baby haircut. My wife will let me throw ours away anyway. So she collected this from her patients, parents of her patients had autism, and also took some controls, and he was able to show, as the next slide will show you, that the mercury level in the hair of autistic children was much less than in the control group. Now this shocked me at first, because I would not think about that before. This study has been confirmed by the MIT group, a very good group at MIT. This original study used a commercial lab that did atomic absorption detection. The MIT group used a more sophisticated detection system. So two different systems have shown that autistic children have less mercury in their hair than the control group. There have been other criticisms that Amy Holmes is a private practitioner. The next slide.
Doctor, before you go on, so the fact that they have less mercury in their hair than controls, what does that mean?
It means that we know that the hair is an excretory organ and that the hair is reflective of the mercury or the metal in the blood. And the blood is a reflection of the mercury in the tissues. And so the fact that the autistic children had less mercury in their hair was a hint or an indication that perhaps there was mercury efflux disorder.
Thank you. And was there another study that supports your belief that autism could potentially be an efflux disorder?
Dr. Jeff Bradstreet was the lead author in the study entitled A Case-Control Study of Mercury Burden in Children with Autistic Spectrum Disorders. This group gave DMSA, a chelating agent, that would bind the mercury in the cell and would not need the efflux mechanism. The DMSA mercury chelate would come out of the cell and the mercury would be excreted in the urine. And this study showed that DMSA increased the urinary excretion of mercury 3 to 6-fold more than found in non-autistic children. Now this is an indication of an increased body burden of mercury in these children.
Now, Doctor, you said it's a chelating agent. What exactly is a chelating agent?
A chelating agent is the word chelating comes from the word chelos from Greek, which means claw, like the claw of a lobster. And you can think of a chelating agent as a lobster claw that hooks up and ties up metal. The chelating agent has a greater affinity for that metal than the protein to which the metal is attached in the cell. That chelate is also the metal and the chelating agent form a chelate. The chelate is also more water soluble than the metal by itself. You must remember, metals just don't float around in the body itself. Metals are attached to proteins and other cell types. And so this chelating study is an indication of an increased body burden.
Yeah, so is this like an artificial means to remove a toxic substance that the body itself cannot remove?
Yes. Now, the There's one more critical thing. When I had a test, when I was asked to testify before the Institute of Medicine, I pointed out that it was a shame that with all the money that had been spent to study autism, no one had gotten tissues that were available in various banks of autistic children to show whether there was an increased concentration of mercury in the tissues. Because if there is, then that would be another piece of evidence for a mercury efflux disorder in autistic children. And just within the last month or so, I think the next slide will show a study by Adams et al., 207, where he took baby teeth. Baby teeth are a... Teeth are an organ. They're not an excretory organ. They're one of the tissues or organs of our body. Baby teeth were used by Needleman at Harvard many years ago to show that children exposed to levels of lead in which there are no obvious signs of toxicity, these children with subclinical lead exposure, as we call it, had teeth that contained low amounts of mercury, that contained high amounts of mercury, high amounts of lead in that case, and their intelligence was impaired. So the use of baby teeth for detecting mercury or lead or other metals is well documented in the scientific literature. And what Adams found was baby teeth mercury in autistic children is greater than in non-autistic children. And as controls, he was able to show the zinc and the lead were not different. It was just the mercury that was different. So again, it appears autistic children have a greater body burden of mercury.
Doctor, what do these four papers tell you about the relationship between mercury and autism?
Significance of these four papers. Next slide. Autistic children lack an effective mercury efflux system. They can't get rid of mercury in the cell. They can take mercury into the cell, but they can't get rid of it. That's true for the brain. It's true for about all the tissues.
And Doctor, when you say it's true for all the tissues in the body, does that include the immune system tissues
as
well?
Absolutely. The immune system has, there are a lot of proteins with subtitle groups that are in the immune system, as we call this huge system. And they, the mercury combined has a great affinity for subtitle groups. And when that combination is made, usually that protein cannot do what it's normally supposed to do.
So, Doctor, what would be the danger associated with an inability to excrete mercury from, say, a system like the immune system?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Could you speak louder, please?
Sure. What would be the dangers of an increased level of mercury in the body system?
Can we wait until we get to a later point?
Certainly.
Thank you. This shows you what ethyl mercury efflux in the autistic tissue. If I have a diagram, it allows me to clear my thinking. I might help some people here. The top is non-autistic tissue, if you will. The blue spots are mercury. And in a normal individual, you're going to have the mercury moving from the tissue to the blood. It will move to the from the blood to the hair, or go up to the other hair, the urine, and feces. But essentially, it goes to the hair as one of the excretories. But in an autistic child, there is an inhibition of the mercury efflux system so that the mercury stays in the tissue, the blood level is left low, and the hair level is low.
And is that an indication that the autistic children are unable to excrete mercury?
Yes, that's a very clear indication. It appears that autistic children lack an effective mercury efflux system, which will affect many body systems, including the immune system.
And Doctor, what would be the effect of having an existing mercury load on the body systems?
Can we skip the slide? Let's we first talk about the Pichero study, in which he took normal children and vaccinated them and followed the toxicogenetics, how fast the mercury came out from aerosol. And the interpretation, these are his interpretations, administration of vaccine containing chimerosol does not seem to raise blood concentration of mercury above safe levels in infants. Ethyl mercury seems to be eliminated from blood rapidly via the stools after parenteral administration of chimerosol vaccine. The problem with this study is it was done with normal children. Children who do not, who are not autistic, children who do not have a mercury efflux disorder. If he had also taken autistic children, children with a mercury efflux disorder, he would have found that the kinetics were entirely different. He would not have been able, he would not have gotten these kinds of figures that are in his paper. And the next slide, chimerosol pharmacokinetics obtained using non-autistic children are not the same as those expected for autistic children. The latter appear to have different efflux kinetics.
And doctor, with the different efflux kinetics, does that mean that the children retain mercury in a greater amount than control children?
Yes, yes.
And doctor, the fact that they retain mercury to a greater extent, is there harm to all the body tissues, such as the immune system?
Oh, yes. Let me first answer your question. I, many years ago, resigned a tenure-track position to go study entomology with a Nobel laureate, Metropolitan Biochemistry at Stanford University School of Medicine. And one thing we learned very quickly was if you wanted to inhibit an enzyme, just throw in mercuric mercury. And we also could show that you gave mercuric mercury to an experimental animal, that same enzyme would be inhibited in vivo. So we know that mercury gets into all the cells. And in one form or another, it will be there and it will affect all the functions that are going on in the cell to a different extent. But certainly the immune system would be one such function. Now, I would also, if I can have the next slide, as we're talking about autism, everyone says, well, the epidemiology studies, the IOM, said the epidemiology studies clearly show there's no connection between chimerosol and autism. There's no cause, non-effect. I want to remind all of us that epidemiology studies do not prove cause and effect. If you go into any medical textbook of epidemiology, it'll clearly say that epidemiology studies reveal statistical correlations. Now, when you correlate, you're comparing one or two items, or three or four items. If you don't pick the right data to compare, don't pick the right groups to compare, then you're going to get a negative answer. The key to being a good epidemiologist is to pick the right data. And this certainly has not been done in my opinion.
Doctor, have there been recent studies that have looked at the differences between methylmercury and ethylmercury in primates?
There has been a very nice study by Dr. Tom Burbacher, who has been working with methylmercury since at least the 1990s. If I can have this next slide, please. Here we are. Thank you. He took infant monkeys. He can't do these experiments in obviously. Human infants, but he took infant monkeys and gave methylmercury by oral gavage and gave thimerosal by IM injection, trying to replicate as much as possible the vaccine schedules in a monkey. And what he was able to show was that methylmercury had a half-life of 21.5 days in these animals, whereas thimerosal had a biphasic half-life, 2.1 days and one at 8.6 days. It's interesting to note that this 8.6 days is a normal animal. That 8.6 days is not too far away from the study showed in humans. But what was of very great interest, especially to me and to other people that are very much interested in this sort of thing, is that even though the total mercury in the brain of the monkeys receiving thimerosal was one-third that of the total mercury received of the methylmercury administered animals, the brain inorganic mercury, which we believe many of us believe to be very, very toxic, the brain inorganic mercury as percentage of the total of the brain total mercury was 34%. 34% of the total mercury in the brain was mercuric mercury for those animals with thimerosal, while only 7% of the total mercury in the brains of the animals getting methylmercury.
So what is the significance of that?
That these two agents are doing different things into the brain, that the thimerosal in particular is leaving in the brain a form of mercury, mercuric mercury, that's going to stay there a very, very long time. Next.
So, Doctor, when you compare methylmercury to ethylmercury, did you come to any conclusions at all?
There's a tremendous amount of scientific literature dealing with methylmercury. It's been studied a long, 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 long time. There's not as much with ethylmercury, and although the two molecules, methylmercury and ethylmercury, are different, there are many problems. And many of the properties are different. There are also similarities. I mean, you can't say there are no similarities. Their distribution in the blood, the compartmentalization in the blood of methylmercury and ethylmercury are the same. They're both excreted. The main route of excretion for both of them is via the feces and the bile. The methylmercury scientific literature can serve as a guide or a path for investigating ethylmercury, and a lot of people are doing this at the present time.
Doctor, when you looked at this data, did you come to any conclusions about autism and its relationship to mercury?
In my opinion, the scientific evidence supports the concept of thimerosal, mercury-containing compound, thimerosal, triggers a response in many systems, let's say in the immune system. And later on, I'll show a diagram that will pull all this together for you, if I may. But I also want to point out that most complex diseases are the results of three factors: genetic susceptibility, environmental exposures, and the stage of development. I think the next slide will have that picture, hopefully. Here we are. Again, you must forgive me. I have to see things more than just think about them. This is a possible path for ethylmercury toxicity that I've tried out on some of my associates and bright students. We have thimerosal. As soon as it gets into the body, it's going to be converted to ethylmercury. That ethylmercury is a form of environmental stress, if you will. And the susceptibility of people to ethylmercury, probably there is, as I show you, the genetic component of the dentist with the amalgams, probably effective here. And the environmental stress goes on to cause ethylmercury goes on to cause immune dysregulation. And the immune dysregulation, the result of that will be immunosuppression. Now, if there's a measles virus in the system at the time, this immune suppression should allow that measles virus to exert its pathogenic effects. And this should cause encephalopathy and going on to autism. Now, another way of looking at it also is that ethylmercury causes a decrease of glutathione. Glutathione is the primary protection in the body against mercury. It transports mercury out of the cell. It transports mercury out to the into the bile. It's a very essential component as far as safety of mercury or the decrease of toxicity of mercury. And the decreased GSH will result in an oxidative stress and increase the amount of free radicals. And both the ethyl mercury directly, rather than other, we have this environmental window. The brain, as you remember, is developing continuously, at least until puberty, and some people would say it's developing even after puberty. So we have these processes going on in the brain, and we know from the biology of development animals that these windows are very, very narrow. They're very narrow. And that the oxidative stress or the ethyl mercury can affect one of these environmental windows at a particular time. Now, we're often asked, why did everyone, why did every child that would get vaccinated, why did every child get autism? I want to remind you that not every child got his second batch of vaccination at age 1 month. Some got it at age 1 month plus 3 days, some got it at age 1 month 5 days, some got it at age 1 month minus 2 or 3 days. So this window could be a very narrow one where ethyl mercury or the oxidative stress go to have its effect. And so one possible explanation is why all children get vaccinated, or all children didn't get autism from vaccination, is that they all were not vaccinated at exactly the same time in development.
So doctor, are you saying that the environmental agent has to come in at a particular point in time to cause harm?
I didn't quite hear all of that.
I said, are you saying that the environmental agent has to come in at a particular point in a child's development to cause harm?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Different. We know that from studies with many, many agents. Textbooks are filled with agents that have a specific time in which they exert a toxic effect. And if the exposure is during that time, you get that toxic effect. If it's after that time, there'll be no toxic effect. If it's before that time, there'll be no toxic. So there's a window. There's a window for every process.
And does that include the immune system as well?
Absolutely.
Now, doctor, at some point in time, did you determine whether the amount of mercury that Michelle Sedillo received exceeded any reference point?
Yes. This shows you the mercury. What we're plotting here is, first of all, the EPA RFD down in the bottom. They really, they should be different symbols. All right, we can take the symbols that we got. And then we're plotting the microgram of mercury per kilogram body weight for Michelle Sedillo. And at the first day of her hike, she received the reverse vaccination. At that time, that vaccination gave her 34 times, in one time, a bolus, 34 times the dose that's considered EPA RFD for methylmercury. And at 2 months, it was 43 times the EPA RFD. At 8 months, you can see 36. So these are large doses compared to what the EPA considers a safe, continuous dose of methylmercury. And these doses of thimerosal are given at one time, not every day over a period of time. The next slide will show something about the cumulative dose. We're now applying the cumulative mercury exposure and comparing it to the standard EPA RFD for methyl mercury. And you can see that the exposure, not talking about body burden, I'm talking about exposure, what the child was exposed to, is really 10 micrograms of mercury per kilogram, which is almost 100 times more than the RFD.
Doctor, did you come to any sort of conclusions whether the thimerosal dose that Michelle Sedillo received was was a substantial contributing factor to the onset, to the development of her neurodevelopmental problems?
Yes. Michelle Cedillo received 75 micrograms of mercury from ethylmercury prime aerosol-containing vaccines during the first 4 months of her life. By 18 months of age, she received a total of 137.5 micrograms of mercury from her vaccines. No matter how one calculates it and compares it, these are not normal exposures of a child to a toxic agent, especially if she should have genetic hypersusceptibility to mercury species. Next slide, please.
Doctor, in your opinion, the dosages of ethylmercury that Michelle Cedillo received, was that a substantial, could that be a substantial contributing factor to the onset of immune dysfunction?
Oh, absolutely. There are papers, especially from Scandinavian countries, very good papers, that show that mercury will disturb immune function and disturb immunoregulation. No question about it.
And Doctor, having given all this information to the court, would you like to summarize what your opinion is?
The chemical forms of species of mercury are different chemically and have different toxicological properties. The greatest exposure to mercury in the population is via dental amalgams. The CNS, the brain, the central nervous system of fetus and children are most vulnerable to elemental and organic mercury. Pink disease and medical ignorance and conservatism were responsible for pink disease being around as long as it was. Methyl mercury from fish can accumulate in women and be transferred across the placenta. Scientific evidence supports the occurrence of a mercury efflux disorder in autistic children. Ethyl mercury is converted to mercuric mercury faster than occurs for methyl mercury. Mercuric mercury in the brains of ethyl mercury treated infant monkeys was 34% of the total mercury, but for the methyl mercury treated animals, it was only 7%, as shown by Burbach. Although the two molecules, methyl mercury and ethyl mercury, are different in structure and many of their properties are different, there are similarities. Methyl mercury can act as a guide for understanding ethyl mercury. For some reason, the next sentence did not come across here, and I have it, but I'll need to read it. It is plausible that Michelle Cedillo may have genetic hypersusceptibility to mercury species, which would trigger unusual immune and toxic responses. I think that's the last one. Do I have the next one?
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you, Ms. Chin-Kaplan. Did the respondent have any cross-examination for this witness?
Actually, we do, Your Honor, but we thought, in view of the time, it might be, we were going to ask for a short break before we did our cross anyway, but perhaps we should just take the lunch hour now and come back and do the cross after that.
Does that sound reasonable to you, Ms. Chin-Kaplan? All right, with no objection, let's go ahead and take our lunch break now, and we start again in 1 hour. It's now 12:10, we'll start about 1:10.